Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, January 23rd. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Doctors Sarchino at McGuire Podiatrists, with offices in Greenwich, New York, and Bennington, Vermont. Surgery for the foot and ankle, nyfootsurge.com for more information. Joining us this afternoon is Dr. Colin Hurst, a cardiologist with Albany Associates in Cardiology, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners. He practices interventional cardiology and structural heart interventions. The number to call if you have a question is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Always best to call early on this program. You can also email voxpop@wamc.org. But the number again is 800-348-2551. Your heart next. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. In the studio this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. Colin Hurst, a cardiologist with Albany Associates in Cardiology, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners Medical Associates. Dr. Hurst practices interventional cardiology and structural heart interventions, including coronary artery stent placement, transcatheter heart valve interventions, catheter-based left atrial appendage occlusion, and catheter-based PFO closure. He's also trained to care for cardiogenic shock patients who may require temporary mechanical support. Dr. Hurst is board certified in internal medicine, echocardiography, cardiovascular diseases, and interventional cardiology. If you want to be a part of the show, call early. 800-348-2551 is our number, 800-348-2551, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Colin Hurst, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Ray.
Great to have you on the program. Now, I know from our chat just now, you are a football fan, and I'm a football fan. I wonder if we could start with the events of a few weeks ago in Buffalo. Damar Hamlin, defensive back for the Bills, took a hit. Heart stopped. There were frantic efforts to revive him. Tell us what exactly happened, if you know.
What I would say first is that, you know, hats off to the medical personnel that were there at the field to end up providing, you know, such swift intervention. And, you know, to get to the mechanism about what happened, I think that if you take a look at the tape, it becomes, you know, pretty clear. He ends up getting a hit probably at the exact wrong time. So it's a very forceful impact to his chest at the exact wrong time. He rises to his feet and then a couple of seconds later falls to the ground. You know, and that type of presentation probably is most consistent with a ventricular arrhythmia, ventricular fibrillation, and that probably was induced with the large forceful impact at the exact wrong moment.
So you say it happened at the exact wrong time. Now, I remember a story of a kid, I don't know if it was locally or nationally, baseball player, pitcher, hit with a line drive. They revived him on the field. Same thing, I believe. When you say the wrong time, what are you talking about?
Well, in the cardiac cycle, the electrical signal is propagated throughout the heart, and there is a certain point in time that if the heart were stunned, that there could be an abnormal rhythm that was precipitated by the forceful blow. So in local sports media, or if we see around the country certain isolated events where it would be usually a young child or maybe a teenager, a hockey goalie, lacrosse goalie, that you would potentially end up hearing that they had some type of sudden cardiac death event. And, you know, one of the probably the seminal work that was done on this type of problem, and the name for it is commotio cordis, was done by one of the physicians at Tufts Medical Center, Mark Link. He's now down at the University of Texas Southwestern in Dallas, and he ended up developing a model to test this hypothesis. And this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It just so happens that I had the privilege of training at Tufts Medical Center, and also interacting, you know, with this physician team. So, You know, it's something that from a phenomenon that had been hypothesized, tested, and then reported in the medical literature. So, you know, this is something which we know, and it's not due to a structural heart disease, congenital abnormality, either from the electrical system or from the heart muscle itself. It's just that the heart muscle is stunned in its own native electrical current at the exact wrong time. And Damar Hamlin, Damar Hamlin and the way that he interacted immediately following that hit with the rest of his teammates and then fell to the ground, you know, is indicative of that type of response. You know, his heart went into a malignant arrhythmia, and the personnel was there to aggressively resuscitate him. So
now it took a while for them to get him stabilized enough to get him out of there in an ambulance. Did they have, what do they call those?
Defibrillator.
Defibrillator. Did they have those on hand, and did they use those, to your knowledge?
Well, typically in any type of coordinated CPR or cardiopulmonary resuscitative effort, you know, having that at large airports, stadiums, places that where the public will convene is standard practice.
Yeah.
You know, and that is not a departure from some of the health policies that the large organization like the NFL has. And so taking somebody who requires CPR and then understanding what the underlying rhythm is, if this is something which can be shocked back into a normal rhythm, does take a coordinated effort so other folks that are administering chest compressions can then appropriately activate the device, apply the device, and then provide a shock if necessary in a timely fashion.
He's not your patient, but do you think his prognosis is very good for a full recovery?
Well, you know, yesterday, if you know, with the rest of the football fans that are listening in, you could see that he had, you know, to the casual observer, you know, there's no sensorimotor residua that was left after this type of event. And you know, I think that if that is the case, again, with a limited knowledge and not being involved
right.
as a casual commentator with a medical background, you know, I think that it's certainly feasible and reasonable to assume that he would make a full intact recovery. But I think that everybody from a public health concern should be congratulatory of the medical personnel that had been such swift responders for such an organized effort, and everybody who then ended up acting in a very organized cascade to provide him with the care to see the eventual outcome. And I think that he has got a good prognostication moving forward.
Dr. Colin Hurst is our guest today, a cardiologist with Albany Associates in Cardiology. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Tell you what, doctor, before the first break, let's run through a few emails that came in well before the show began. This one's from Marion. I have a trigger finger problem with the ring finger of my left hand. Recently read an online source which said that it could be a sign of a cardiac problem. Is this just a myth, or should I investigate it further?
The trigger finger problem may represent a connective tissue disorder. And to be quite honest with you, it may be true and unrelated.
Okay.
The connective tissue disorders do end up affecting the cardiovascular system, but you know, an isolated trigger finger and understanding the mechanism, if it really has to do with tendinous entrapment, which is typically what you end up seeing. Again, this is, you know, dating all the way back to internal medicine training as well as, you know, medical school. So, you know, again, forgive me because this probably exceeds the scope of my practice at the present time.
Mm. Are you already regretting being on the show?
No, not at all.
This one's from Christine in Watervliet. My cardiologist has recently prescribed a baby aspirin daily. Realizing that I am not your patient, could this be a forever medication, or could I do anything to get back to where I don't need the aspirin? I try to maintain a healthy lifestyle. That's from Christine in Watervliet.
Well, you know, Christine, that's a great question. And I think that and this is a generalizable question that many people struggle with in the population. And, you know, the truthful answer is that as cardiologists, we're looking to attenuate or lessen the amount of risk that you would end up otherwise being exposed to in the next 10 years. You know, and we have some pretty strong prognosticating tools that allow us to evaluate your risk. And if you were to fall into a risk category where it was thought that potentially the addition of aspirin may help to lessen your overall cardiac risk in the next 10 years, then I think that it's reasonable. But that's also at the cost of exposing you to a medication that potentially increases the likelihood of bleeding. You know, so obviously, whenever we look at any type of intervention, medications or procedures, we're trying to weigh the risk-benefit analysis. You know, if we thought that something was too risky to prescribe at the cost of your health, then that probably wasn't going to be the type of intervention chosen for you. But I think that, you know, if your cardiologist and you have had a conversation about your overall cardiovascular risk and it's thought to be reasonable to decrease your overall risk within the next several years, then I think that that is going to be a medication which will help. And is it a forever medication? You know, not necessarily. If you do end up having bleeding complications, then the risk exceeds the benefit, and that medication may no longer be helpful for you.
Have doctors, cardiologists, somewhat backed away from prescribing the baby aspirin?
Well, not necessarily. I think that it comes with a judicious evaluation of one's personal cardiovascular risk. I don't think that there is a plug-and-chug algorithm for individuals. I think that medicine is individualized. And, you know, also today we are seeing a shared decision-making paradigm as how care is moved forward. You know, the days of paternalistic medicine where, you know, the physician would end up saying, you know, this is what you're going to end up doing is a commandment. I think that those days are changing where, you know, we're really incorporating patients' wishes as well as, you know, the risk and benefit analysis of certain types of therapies, drugs, and or devices. Mm-hmm. And also, I think that it's important to incorporate a little bit of artificial intelligence and machine learning, you know, and these risk prognostication tools that we have available to us allow us to do that.
Well, bonus points for the plug and chug algorithm. I'm going to actually be using that when I wrote that down. Is that a common term?
If I end up using it as a common term, do I end up getting the royalties there, Ray?
You know, we could work something out. The copyright show is coming in a month or two. We'll take a break. We're here with Dr. Colin Hurst. We'll get to your calls in a moment. Vox Pop, Medical Monday on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. We're joined by Dr. Colin Hurst, a cardiologist with Albany Associates in Cardiology. And the number here is 800-348-2551. Let's get to the phones, and we'll start out in Hillsdale. Hannah, you're on.
Hello. Yes. I have a question about the vitamin CoQ10. What do you think about that? I have recently been taking it.
Well, nice to meet you virtually, Hannah, and thank you so much for the question. The CoQ10 supplement can be given with other types of pharmaceuticals, for instance, the statin therapy or lipid-lowering drugs. And that has typically been offered as a co-supplement because there are some reports that CoQ10 helps to lessen the muscle pains if a person who is taking a statin therapy may be afflicted with these muscle pains. This type of medication, for some reports, has been thought to lessen or alleviate those symptoms. And so that's really the primary use of it. In terms of a standalone medication, you know, that it's just another nutraceutical. And those types of standalone nutraceuticals are not FDA regulated. The over-the-counter homeopathic medications,
even fish oil and things like that.
Well, so that's a little bit different. And you know, I think that, you know, the omega-3 fish oils, there are over-the-counter medications. Again, those are also not regulated by the FDA. And there is one specific fish oil, which actually has gone through a randomized clinical trial and has been shown to reduce someone's cardiovascular event rate. That's called Vascepa. And that type of medication is a pharmaceutical which is prescribed by either your primary care physician or your cardiologist. But, you know, those are a little bit different.
Hannah, you want to follow up?
Yeah, well, I am taking the statin. I am taking Lipitor. And I do have some issues with my legs and, you know, just aches and pains and stuff like that. So I thought that perhaps this CoQ10 would be helpful.
You know, that again, as a follow-up, Hannah, I think that one of the things that is also often appreciated is that all statins are not made equally. Different statins are actually metabolized by different pathways. And so if you're taking a certain statin therapy, you should engage with your cardiologist or whoever the prescribing provider is, you know, about a different medication within the same class. And that medication may actually have a different or more favorable profile as it relates to muscle-induced pains.
Hannah, thanks for the call. What is it about statins that will give some people leg cramps or muscle aches? What in the statin does that?
It's a great question because I don't think that we truly really know. Some have postulated that it's how it's metabolized, and it's metabolized in the liver, and then how it interacts with sort of the powerhouse of the cell, which would be the mitochondria. And from that, the postulate is that it affects skeletal muscle in a certain way after it's metabolized. But, you know, Ray, I can't tell you the overall mechanism about why it is, but it's highly idiosyncratic. Some patients have it. Some patients don't. Some patients respond to CoQ10. Some patients don't. Really, the way that it's metabolized, and it seems as though that the different classes of the lipid-lowering therapy class, which is statins, but there's medications within the same class that are metabolized in different pathways in the liver, you know, that variation seems to be at play because some patients that end up having statin-induced muscle aches and pains may not actually have statin-induced muscle aches and pains if they were to use a different medication within the same class.
Dr. Colin Hurst joins us from Albany Associates in Cardiology, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We seem to have a tremendous number of emails, so I'll take a couple here before the next call. This one's from Ed in Wilbraham. Why isn't the lipoprotein A test included in a routine lipid panel?
Great question. I think that I can answer that both from a healthcare perspective and then also from a financial perspective. You know, the lipid panel provides us with your total cholesterol, your triglycerides, your low density lipoprotein, or, you know, sometimes I end up calling it lousy cholesterol, as well as high density lipoprotein, And those four allow us to provide, you know, with a pretty robust risk stratification for your 10-year atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk. Lipoprotein A, there's emerging literature that lipoprotein A is with somebody who may actually have a family history of dyslipidemia or a lipid metabolism problem. Excuse me. Sure. And as well as a normal lipid profile. But the lipoprotein A would be elevated, those patients may actually benefit from a statin therapy when the conventional risk prognostication may indicate that they may not be at an increased risk over the next 10 years to justify the use of the medication. So it is an additional test. Now, from the financial standpoint, you know, the insurance companies may not end up offering this type of test as part of their standard lipid panel. However, with the justification of an abnormal family history or that that early onset coronary disease or atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease with early onset stroke or other type of atherosclerotic cardiovascular phenomenon in the family may provide the justification for that test from a financial standpoint.
Ed also has a second question. Ed writes,
a two for one.
Yeah, I know, right? Usually we don't do that. You're catching on very quickly, Dr. Hurst. I had a coronary calcium score of 0 when I was 70. I'm now 73. Is another one ever required?
Another excellent question. I think that this also ends up looking at the overall risk adjudication for somebody who may be at risk for cardiovascular disease. And the calcium score, when you look at it historically, It was developed by a cardiologist in Miami, Florida, and you're looking at sort of what the CT appearance of calcium or CT imaging of plaque in the coronary arteries, and then that information is processed into a score through an algorithm, and then it spits out a score. And you know, this type of risk evaluation has been looked at in a clinical trial, the MESA trial, and they look at patients that are either looked at as low risk, so a patient with 0 to 100 on their calcium score would be low risk, 100 to 400 would be intermediate risk, 400 and above would be high risk, and it just tells us the overall burden of potential coronary disease. That, however, is an anatomic test, meaning that if I knew your anatomy, then I have a better idea about how I would end up treating you. But your anatomy at rest does not tell you a whole lot about the physiology, about whether or not any type of aggregation of calcium or plaque or both in the coronary arteries is flow limiting, meaning that at times of rest versus times at stress, that the blood flow may be impaired in its movement towards the distal coronary bed, evoking symptoms like chest pain or chest discomfort. And so, you know, your question about whether or not a calcium score, it needs to be repeated if you have a calcium score of zero. A calcium score of zero indicates that really there's nothing that was seen on this non-invasive test that indicates that you have the presence of plaque or calcium in your arteries. And in the absence of symptoms, it would be rarely appropriate to look for another repeat test, just as another routine screening.
Dr. Colin Hurst joins us on this edition of Medical Monday. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll get back to the email bag in a moment, but now let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
How does nitric oxide dilate blood vessels?
Great question, Jim. Thanks so much for the phone call. What it does is... Your own body creates nitric oxide, and that's in response to a number of different factors. But one of them is shear stress on the blood vessels, and that shear stress is then translated to a molecular pathway. And the blood cells that interact or interface directly with blood on the inner lining of blood vessels are responsible for their own dilatation and also constriction. And this is one of the mechanisms that your own body will end up helping to dilate the blood vessels. Patients that end up having abnormal circulation, those patients that have plaque or those patients that have calcium or both, may have impairments in generating their own nitric oxide supply. Nitric oxide that you would take as a pill form, if you place it underneath your tongue, or if you end up having a long-acting 24-hour nitrate derivative like isosorbide mononitrate or IMDOR, those act by helping to release this type of agent into the bloodstream to help dilate the blood vessels.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jim. It's Medical Monday today. Dr. Colin Hurst joins us. This email from Claire. Now, Claire wrote a very long email. In fact, it spans two different emails, so I'll try to move quickly to page two. This is, here we go. I am a school nurse, and one of our students sometimes comes to me with a pulse 2 to 3 times the normal rate. 180 is not unusual. The tachycardic episodes occur irregularly and without warning, usually a few times each month, and started last. There is no typical scenario. Often the student, a seventh grade girl, is seated in class. She was seen by a, and then I have to go to the other email. She was seen by something. It's not even in there. The tachycardia started last spring. The student was seen by a cardiologist last fall. Now takes a beta blocker. The rapid change in rate is quite impressive. 180s, then suddenly back to a normal rate below 100. Then may cycle up and down a few times within a few minutes. The student is always alert and looks fine, although understandably a bit unnerved. Her diagnosis is SVT. Any advice for managing these events during the school day? Rest, observation, reassure, inform parent, ask for guidance from cardiologist. Still waiting on that. That's from Claire, who is an RN.
Thank you very much, Claire, for the call or for the email.
Multiple emails.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, but I think, I think that she ends up bringing up a couple of, I think there's a couple of key points. There is, you know, and those key points really are at the end of the email is, you know, what to do if the patient's in class. And, you know, I think that everybody from the allied health professionals, you know, everyone puts in a significant amount of time, especially those that are in charge of caring for our children that are, you know, in school. So, you know, I think it's appropriate just to say thank you to Claire for, you know, this type of for her commitment to the profession. You know, and the second is, you know, the management of SVT, you know, which really stands for supraventricular tachycardia. You know, there's a number of different supraventricular tachycardias. This is an overarching umbrella diagnosis, and the seventh grade girl who may have this problem, who has undoubtedly seen a cardiologist, is aware of what type of supraventricular tachycardia it may be, and that it's safe for this seventh grade girl to return to class and on a medication that essentially helps to slow down the heart. And one of the ways in which and this is something which has been done, can be done in the hospital as well as can be done in the clinic and also can be done in the school, is asking the patient, you know, if she has these types of symptoms, or if she ends up having an accelerated heart rate with symptoms, you know, bearing down, as if you were trying to really clench your abdominal muscles, and without, you know, trying to, you know, doing something just to really clench down and bear down with, you know, really flexing your abdominal muscles. The other,
what does that do?
Yeah, well, that sometimes, or coughing, and all of those maneuvers, you know, help to raise your parasympathetic tone and potentially interrupt this type of abnormal heart circuit. And it seems as though that, you know, this patient has been followed by a cardiologist. And so, you know, the management of that moving forward can be addressed by the cardiologist and also by the patient. But, you know, in terms of how to deal with it in the classroom, you know, in the absence of really troubling symptoms, you know, some of these types of vagal maneuvers is what we call them, where you're trying to activate the vagus nerve, again, trying to increase the parasympathetic tone, you know, may be helpful to help break this type of cycle of this abnormal rhythm.
Is this something that this kid will have to deal with forever?
Well, not necessarily. I think that, you know, we've actually been pretty good at figuring out these types of abnormal heart rhythms and mapping them in the heart and figuring out how to interrupt them. I think that, you know, first things first, you know, you want to make sure that the patient does not have any underlying structural heart disease. You know, and that can be done with an ultrasound of the heart, and that can also be done with other, you know, provocative, you know, workup. But somebody who is of an age, seventh grade, you want to make sure that they weren't born with some type of abnormal heart structure. And then the second is, you know, the question is she going to end up having to live with this for the rest of her life? We've actually become pretty slick at looking at how these types of abnormal heart rhythms manifest in the heart, tracking them and interrupting them, you know, with simple outpatient catheter-based procedures. And that can be done by seeing a cardiac specialist. Those cardiac specialists are the electrical doctors, also known as electrophysiologists. And those are specialized in heart rhythm disorders. And I think that and pediatric electrophysiologists exist as well as a subspecialty of medicine or of pediatric medicine. And that may be an opportunity for this young girl to interact.
Let's take a quick break. Dr. Colin Hurst is our guest on this edition of Medical Monday. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. It's a Vox Pop Medical Monday, Cardiology Today with Dr. Colin Hurst of Albany Associates in Cardiology, which is a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners. The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. And our friend Joan in Schenectady has been waiting very, very long. Joan, are you still alive?
I am doing well, and thank you very much, Ray. Always a pleasure to listen to the show, so it's never a stress. Ha ha.
Ha ha.
And Dr. Hirsch, thanks for your knowledge. And I, too, took note of plug and chug algorithm. So you might want to register that copyright if
well,
you want to protect it.
I think that, please refer me to the next copyright lawyer.
Yeah, it's coming up in a couple of months on the show. All right, go ahead, Joan.
My question is, I'm watching all my numbers, of course. I'm at the age where things could start happening. And do have a family history of heart attack in one sibling and vascular issues with another sibling. I am wondering about a stress test. Is that still the normative early intervention route? You know, I think it's time for me to move from prevention to intervention. And I'm afraid of the tests, so help.
Yes, I can understand that. Well, number one, thank you very much for your question, and you know, thanks for calling in. And number two, I am empathetic to some of the trepidation, and I think that when I've talked to a lot of my patients, you know, it has to do with what happens if it's positive, and what do I then do? And I think that knowledge is power, and I think that you're going to have to figure out how to end up best looking at your own risk. And the question really becomes, you know, when is a stress test appropriate? And I think that you'll know when you know, right? You know, but that's sort of a vague answer. And I say that because your body is going to end up telling you if you're beginning to have exertional symptoms. And really, you know, we're talking about, you know, if you think about your heart as a car engine and you think about the coronary arteries as fuel lines, you want to know whether or not the fuel lines are kinked or clogged. And when it comes down to it, if the heart is at rest, the heart, like the car, is going to idle and there's not going to be a whole lot of problems. It's when you try to put it into gear and you get on the highway, that's when you have a lot of problems, just like when you're trying to exercise. And that demand and flow limiting mismatch that you're going to end up getting with either a blocked or congested heart arteries is going to be more apparent. And so if you're beginning to have symptoms, or if you feel as though that the same get up and go you used to have just sort of get up and went, or if you end up feeling like you're short of breath, or if you have chest discomfort, or if you have both, or if you're starting to, you know, sort of say, well, you know, doc, I'm really having some difficulty sleeping. I'm now using 1, 2, 3 pillows to sit up at night. I'm starting to retain some fluid. You know, these are types of things that, you know, you should be aware of and let your cardiologist know that, you know, now it's moving from prevention because we're talking about the onset of symptoms. And this goes for everybody, right? If you move from looking at your risk and then providing the appropriate risk adjudication and then moving to, well, you know, not only do I have risk and potentially a family history, which is a component of risk, and then I also have symptoms, you know, that becomes a different discussion with either your primary care provider, you know, at which point it may need to be time to refer to a cardiologist, or that it is time for you to have a good discussion with your cardiologist about what type of intervention is necessary. And, you know, looking at certain types of complaints like chest discomfort as well as shortness of breath are very vague and nondescript complaints. You really want to know whether or not it's related to your heart. And I think that, you know, the stress test that you mentioned is a good first step. And what type of stress test? And we can end up getting into what type of stress test is, you know, the best. But I think that if you can exercise without getting into sort of it's the choice of a stress test is sort of nuanced. And I'm going to end up leaving that discussion, tabling that discussion. But I think that, you know, the best is that if you can end up exercising, that provides us with additional information about your 5-year risk as it relates to cardiovascular disease. And if you can end up exercising and you can end up on a treadmill and other people can't, you know, it's based due to either orthopedic problems or deconditioning or both, you know, but if you can exercise and try to exercise to the maximum of your ability, you know, that does provide us with, you know, another element of information that helps to inform the decision-making process after you get the results. So.
All right, Joan, thanks a lot for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll go now to Pine Bush. Gail, you're on.
Hello, Dr. Hirsch. My name is Gail Fisher. I'm calling for a very simple question. There are a lot of personal air purifiers out there that you can wear around your neck, but they also are up against your heart. And I was wondering, would they affect your heart?
Thank you very much, Gail, for the question. I am not aware of any of these personal air purifiers that you can wear around your neck. I have yet to see one.
Nor have I.
And so that's something that, you know, probably as it, and the question is, you know, is there any type of risk that is that using this type of device or wearing this type of apparatus, you know, poses to,
right.
to your heart? And I'm at the present time, I'm not aware of any of any risk that it would pose. But I'm also unfamiliar with the device itself. So, you know, maybe that just exceeds the scope of my knowledge at the present time.
Okay, Gail.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. Right. We appreciate it very much. This is Medical Monday. We're joined by Dr. Colin Hurst, a cardiologist with Albany Associates in Cardiology. This email from Jared in Utica. I'm a 38-year-old male with moderate aortic stenosis. I've had two angioplasties at 8 and 14 years old, and I've been stable since. I'm curious to know at what point someone like myself would be a candidate for transcatheter aortic valve replacement.
That is that's a very poignant question, because that's one of the that is an intervention that I perform, and that also falls within the subspecialty wheelhouse. And we at St. Peter's have a wonderful multidisciplinary team that consists of cardiothoracic surgeons, interventional cardiologists, general cardiologists that specialized in echocardiography and imaging, as well as our radiology colleagues that also specialized in imaging. You know, and at 38 years of age, for the general public's knowledge, usually degenerative, calcified, senile aortic stenosis is usually something that we end up incurring in the septuagenarians, octogenarians, so 70, 80, and 90-year-olds that may otherwise come to us as an evaluation for intervention, surgical versus transcatheter approach. But at 38 years of age, it usually is because of an abnormality that a patient has been born with. And again, no fault of their own. It's just that, you know, the aortic valve may have not developed in a way which the regular general population has an aortic valve development. And so you're talking about either a unicuspid aortic valve, a bicuspid aortic valve, or a quadricuspid aortic valve. And those, just because of the way that flow through the aortic valve occurs, that the deterioration of the valve occurs at such a more frequent and much more rapid pace. And in your specific case, you know, really what you want to do is you want to end up interacting with a multidisciplinary team, you know, like the one that we have at St. Peter's, that's going to provide you with the ongoing surveillance. I think that, you know, with moderate aortic stenosis at such a long, at such an early age, the conversation really should be the lifetime management of your valvular disease. And when I say that, there are different options to manage your lifetime. There's different options to manage your valvular disease. And there's surgical as well as transcatheter. And that discussion that you'll have with the multidisciplinary heart team really should end up helping to provide you with the best treatment pathway so that you would be able to live a long and successful, healthy life, irrespective of your valve disease. That type of trajectory can be laid out for you, whether or not we're talking about a surgical intervention first, followed by a transcatheter intervention, and trying to limit the amount of exposure that you would have with either one open heart surgery or multiple. And, you know, also it's important to sort of take into account patients' wishes. I think that, as I had mentioned before, this is a shared decision-making process. And, you know, you have to have some, at least some input, as well as confidence and trust in the team that you're going to end up interacting with. So I think that the take-home points are, you know, early recognition, ongoing surveillance, interaction with a multidisciplinary structural heart team that includes cardiothoracic surgeons as well as interventional cardiologists, and also a frequent open line of communication with your clinical cardiologist as well as the imaging specialist, who will continue to surveil you for worsening of the disease.
This email from Richard, vascular question. Can vascular disease in the brain that causes silent stroke cause seizures? And can a cardiologist help treat this? And that's from Richard.
Wow, Richard. A powerful question. And also, I think that for as it relates to the public's knowledge of cardiovascular disease, you know, we're talking about all of the arteries in the body that may be afflicted with plaque deposition or calcium deposition or both. And the small arteries of the brain are no different than the small arteries of the heart that are no different than the small arteries potentially of the kidneys. And you may have different phenomena that end up presenting in different ways. And so it's certainly possible to end up having cerebrovascular disease that will end up leading to a clinically significant event, such as a TIA or a trans-ischemic attack, or some people end up colloquially referring to this as a mini stroke, you know, or a stroke that ends up leaving you with some type of sensory, motor, or both type of deficit. And the question is whether or not you can end up having this type of event and that the sequelae would then be a seizure. Is that possible? You know, certainly. And that may be possible with a very large type of cerebrovascular disease, but event. But I think that, you know, that type of clinical association is probably a little bit more individualized than what you would end up seeing in, you know, everyday standard practice with everybody that ends up having a stroke or ends up having evidence of cerebrovascular disease on imaging.
Dr. Colin Hurst is our guest today from Albany Associates in Cardiology. One more email here, then we'll jump back on the phones. This is from Lori in Enfield, Connecticut. My GP has recommended a carotid artery test, just a precaution due to a parent having cardiac issues. I'm healthy, 69 years, very young, says Lori.
You know, Lori, Enfield, Connecticut. I grew up in Connecticut, so, you know, my heart goes out to the residents of Connecticut. So that's sort of my own selfless.
We have a lot of listeners there.
Yeah, so my own selfless, shameless plug of, okay. you know, go Constitution State. Now, as it relates to your carotid arterial scan, there's a couple of ways to look at these, but what your general practitioner has provided you with is the opportunity to take a look at your carotid arteries with an ultrasound. You know, and in the past, we have used carotid artery intimal thickening, or the layer of the carotid artery which interacts or interfaces with the blood as a marker or surrogate marker of peripheral arterial disease or just atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, meaning that if the large arteries of the carotid or if the large arteries of the body, like the carotid arteries, are affected with plaque deposition or intimal thickening, then the conclusion is that other arteries of the body would also be affected. And that provides justification for the intensification of ongoing treatment or the initiation of treatment. You know, so I think that, you know, there's value to that.
Okay, let's go back to our phone lines with Dr. Colin Hurst, Jim in Adams, Massachusetts. Jim.
Hey, Ray.
Hello.
Yes, good afternoon to you, Doctor, too, as well. Excellent show.
Hi, thanks.
I heard recently that swelling on the feet, ankles, lower legs can be a possible indication of congestive heart failure, or could it be perhaps an indication of venous insufficiency where the valves in the veins are not operating as optimum levels anymore? I've had swelling on my feet and lower legs for several years. I put a wedge pillow under my feet at the bottom of the bed every night. That brings it down by morning. My feet are back to normal.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, and that's often a question that we see in our clinic for many patients that come in with undifferentiated lower extremity swelling. You know, I think that, you know, the big question is whether or not you have, you know, a localization of the swelling to one leg or to another. If it's to one leg and it's not to the other, then you really have to be concerned that there may be a DVT, which is probably going to be one of the things that, you know, from a public health standpoint is should be recognized, should be treated, and it also can end up leading to other types of more serious complications if left untreated. And that DVT stands for deep venous thrombosis. There's a lot of public service announcements that are mentioned, but you know, one leg versus both legs being affected does affect what the differential diagnosis would be. And what you're describing is two legs are affected, meaning that it's a process where both lower extremities either have a problem, a vascular problem, you know, which is what you're commenting on with venous insufficiency, you know, versus volume retention or fluid retention as a result of either impaired pumping function of the heart or impaired relaxation of the heart. And I think that what you're describing, where at the end of the day, elevating your feet and having a resolution of that swelling is more consistent probably with the diagnosis of venous insufficiency. As you know, we're sort of, you know, as we're two-footed upright human beings, you know, we have to battle the effect of gravity and the accumulation of and also poor movement in venous tone, I would say probably like the lack thereof as we get older, you know, leads to just the swelling and accumulation of blood in the lower extremities, and then can also end up leading to fluid accumulation, you know, which at the end of the day, if you raise your legs, you know, all of that ends up resolving. And again, it sort of indicates more that the diagnosis is probably venous insufficiency than it is for, you know, congestive heart failure.
Well, Jim, oops, that's my microphone. Hello, Jim, and thank you for calling. This email from Richard. What are the potential consequences of a dilated carotid artery? We only have, by the way, 45 seconds.
Right. You know, I can end up, you know, look, we can sort of get into keeping it short. You know, I think that a dilated carotid artery, it probably needs to be evaluated by a vascular disease specialist, a vascular surgeon, and they will be able to provide you with the opinion as to whether or not it needs to end up being fixed or continued with medical management.
All right. Joe Mackowitz, is Stephanie ready in Crescent City? No. Okay, well, we'll have to... somebody from Crescent City, California called. I thought we would try to get her on, but we're just about out of time here. Dr. Colin Hurst, you did a splendid job on this show.
Well, thanks very much, Ray, for having me, and I really appreciated the opportunity to field some calls. This was wonderful. Thanks again.
Yeah. Were you nervous at all?
Well, I don't think so, but did it come off as I was nervous?
No, you seemed very calm on the radio, but you never know. Sometimes you can have a storm raging inside you. Hey, listen, thanks a lot for being here. Support comes from Upstate Dermatology for more than 30 years, providing medical and surgical dermatology services, including Mohs surgery with 5 locations in the Capital Region, upstatederm.com. Once again, thanks to Dr. Colin Hurst of Albany Associates in Cardiology for joining us today. Very informative program. Thank you for listening, and thanks for calling. Thanks for the emails. Sorry if we did not get to yours. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, our engineer. Joe Mackowitz screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to bark up your family tree. Tracy Scrabbit returns for a genealogy show. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.